This is entitled Cognitive Linguistics and the Prepositions in 1 John. I'm probably going to spend as much time on defining what cognitive linguistics is, and it's going to have to be a very brief version of that as well, because I imagine most of you probably don't have any idea what that is, so I want to talk about what that is, and then just do a little exploration of Eck and N in 1 John using some of those categories. But again, that part is, it's going to be even probably more on the cognitive linguistics side. So, well, let me start with a word, an English word, and that word is just house. So when I say the English word house, what happens in our brains, right? Or how about if I say in the house, or by the house, or on the house, under the house, through the house? There's a lot of stuff going on in your brain when I say those English phrases. And even though the greatest computer ever designed, the human brain, will always remain a mystery, none of us will really understand all that's going on in the human brain. Recent decades of research and newer technologies related to neuropsychology have enabled us some understanding of a few things that are happening in our brains when we encounter language. For example, we know that when I said the word house, that actually the first part of your neural network that fired was, maybe surprisingly, was actually your visual cortex. That fired before anything else. You imagined you saw a house of some sort. Now, it may have happened so quickly that you don't fully recognize it, that it was an image, but it still happened. We know from neuro studies on this. The reason an image of a house may or may not have registered consciously, even though we know your visual cortex fired, was because it's such a familiar and oft-used word in our current English that it functions more quickly, so you're not even aware of it. But when I say houseboat, I guarantee you that an image flashed across your visual cortex, one that you're probably a little bit more familiar with. And if I say a scary old house from a horror movie, for me it's the Munsters come to mind. I don't know why, but even though that wasn't scary, you maybe don't even know what the Munsters are. Some of you older people do. Or if I say the White House in D.C., there's an image that you get. It goes very quickly, but we know that's what's happening in your brains. Now, what I'm saying is really just the tip of the tip of the iceberg of a very deep and wild field of interrelated studies, metaphor theory, cognitive science, philosophy of language, translation theory, sociocultural linguistics, and maybe one of the broadest categories we can call these things, although they're all kind of their own fields, we can refer in a lot of ways to this as cognitive linguistics. So what is cognitive linguistics? Well, that term originally comes from a very influential book by a very, very influential philosopher of language and researcher named George Lakoff. He had first become very famous, and I've given you a bibliography at the end of the handout. He first became very famous with his brilliant and, I mean, majorly influential book. It is really hard to overestimate the influence of Lakoff's book, Metaphors We Live By. But then he, in a kind of sequel to that called Women, Fire, and Dangerous Things, which is a pretty killer title for a book, where he talks about these kind of issues, he first coined the term cognitive linguistics there. Over the decades since, it has, of course, evolved, developed, and impacted countless other fields of study and inquiry and research, philosophically, linguistically, neurologically. And it combines, it really, and informs a lot of other fields of study, again, psychology, philosophy, culture, history of languages, linguistics, issues of body and mind, neuroscience, sociocultural linguistics, all these things are related. To put it one way, to quote someone, the field of cognitive linguistics explains that meaning is encyclopedic in nature, that is, word meaning, which is what we all care about, cannot be understood independently of the vast repository of encyclopedic knowledge to which it is linked. So let me explain what that means. A word is like a node in a network that gives access to larger cultural storehouses of practices, customs, institutions, attitudes, emotions, values, concepts, stories, schemes, values. In other words, the way language works, we know, and it, well, we'll just say from, I'm a cognitive linguistic follower, so within this framework, how we understand language works is language is embedded in culture and in experiences that people have within a culture, and languages vary quite a bit in how they function at lexically and syntactically and all these kind of ways by in ways that are deeply affected by the experience of the culture itself. Those things are not separate. To use the language of someone else who was not technically a cognitive linguist, but his ideas are very similar on the more philosophical side, that would be Umberto Eco, E-C-O. In his, you can read a lot of Eco, but in his little beautiful little book, Experiences in Translation, or another good one that I used in a PhD seminar last semester called Mouse or Rat Translation as Negotiation. I didn't put that one on the bibliography. That's a great way to get at these ideas as well. But Umberto Eco deals with this question of what is language. And again, you may not have ever, that's why I'm talking about this stuff. I imagine most of you never really asked yourself that question, what is language? But there's been a lot of philosophical debate for centuries and centuries, well, millennia really, about what language is. And Eco says, he rejects what some people would, this notion of a reine Sprache, that is a pure language that is kind of separate and above all, you know, actual languages. He rejects that idea, as I would as well, this pure universal language or mentalese, because he notes that every language really functions in its own way. It doesn't mean that you can't translate, you really can, but it means that every language structures the world and views the world in a slightly different way. And as you know, if you're bilingual, all translation requires negotiation or navigation. And I'm sure there are several people in here that are bilingual, and you know that whenever you're translating, it's not that you can't communicate, it is, but there's always things that are gained and lost in translation. That's because languages are better embedded in culture. They're not this kind of thing that's separate and above human experience. They are part of the human experience, so there's always a translation. So Eco says, if it's impossible to speak of equivalence in meaning when you go across languages, one should then say that every language has its own genius, to quote Humboldt, or rather that every language expresses a different worldview. That's what's called the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis. And Eco goes on to explore, for example, the different connotations of French bois, English wood, timber, woods, compared to the Italian bosco and German Holz and Wald. We might gloss those all as kind of woods or something, but every one of them has their own connotations that are based on the culture that that language is embedded in. Do you see what I mean? Right? And add to this, then, when you put such words into sentences that are embedded in certain cultural contexts, such as, and my French isn't as good as yours, Andres, and others probably in here, but La Belle au Bois Dormant. So that French phrase evokes a story that we in English call Sleeping Beauty, but even if you don't know French, you could probably figure out that the translation of that we say Sleeping Beauty, you could also say the beautiful woman who's asleep in the woods, right? So even a very familiar sort of old story, how you title it, how the French think about what that story is very different than how we think about it by its title, right? Sleeping Beauty versus this woman who's asleep in the woods. What Eco goes on to say then, translating is not only connected then with linguistic competence, but with intertextual, psychological, and narrative competence, that is understanding how a language is functioning in its own culture. Okay, and this is all gonna matter for the New Testament, you can imagine probably. So let me say just a couple more things about cognitive linguistics, just a few ideas that are used in this world to help explain it. One is the idea of frames and construal. These are a couple of, so I'm just going to give you some terms that are used in the world of cognitive linguistics, frames and construal. That is the idea that words both reflect and affect how we experience the world. So, in other words, there are cultural frames that provide a gestalt, is a word sometimes you use to kind of describe it's hard to translate, right? To describe a kind of a way of seeing the world. And words activate a certain sort of understanding or set of associations. Let me just give you some examples, because I'm talking abstractly here. And I want to give you some examples from a book I'm reading right now, very fresh, by Gaston Doren, who's a Dutchman. His fascinating book called Babel, Around the World in 20 Languages, where he takes the 20 most spoken languages throughout the world in ascending order and writes a little chapter about each of them, kind of their history and how they function. It's a linguistic nerd's dream book. It's a Christmas gift present, and I read it almost every day. It's a lot of fun. I'll just give you some examples of things he says about these different languages that really, I think, show a cognitive linguistic idea of frames and construal. Take, for example, the language Javanese. Any Javanese speakers here? It's Indonesian, basically, is the main language spoken in Indonesian area. Like many languages, Javanese has different registers. That is, when we say register in linguistics, we mean a kind of style and level and form of usage. So a lot of languages, even English, has a kind of more polite style. So for example, if Dr. Moeller walked in here, or anybody else met somebody, you know, famous or something, you probably aren't going to use ain't, right? Because you're going to know that ain't isn't the right register within English to use. Or when we graduate people, we when they're walking across, we don't read from some fancy thing that says, "And you ain't gonna pay no more money anymore," or something. I mean, that's the wrong register for that situation, right? So we have different registers. Well, a lot of languages have a much more stratified and clear register system. Those of you who speak several Asian languages, you know that. But let me talk about Javanese. There is a polite style of Javanese called the krama. And Korean has this as well, Japanese, and there are layers of suffixes and conjugations and different vocabulary words that you have to use based on the register of the social situation you're in, people above you or below you, strangers, familiar friends, etc. We have this a little bit in English, but not as much. Well, Javanese has this highly developed formal register, or register for formality. There's a form of the language called Noko, N-G-O-K-O, that is very general and neutral. But then there are four other levels of different words that you have to use that express different levels of formality. So there are synonyms, for example, for regular words in the neutral language that you have to use when you're speaking to people above you, and those collectively are called krama. And then in a variety of formal situations, so for example, in a court, you're not allowed to use the neutral lower language. You have to use the krama words. And if you're ever meeting a stranger, you're supposed to use the krama words as well. And then there's a middle level between high and low Javanese, which is a mixture of both krama words with noko endings, plus some unique words. And then you have to use this high krama when speaking to, again, referring to those who have a higher social status than you. And then there's kind of a level of humble krama, or words you're supposed to use. And all of those are used in conjunction with certain parts of the culture that you don't look people above you in the eye. You use your hands in a certain way. You don't point and gesture in certain ways when you're around people of a higher social status. You have to dress a certain way. You don't laugh in the presence of people higher than you, etc. So the point is, in all this, is just one example. This, what Doren and many other linguists and others have observed, is that linguistic structure both reflects and affects the cultural experience of Javanese speakers. Do you see why? Because it provides a construal or a framing of the world that affects real life and real experience, right? And it's a very simple but very actually quite widespread earth human language example of how the language both perpetuates and shapes people to think of themselves in a social structure at the very level of their native tongue. Does that make sense? You with me on that? And those of you who speak languages like Korean, I think, has seven levels of formality, a couple of which are only used in drama and literature, I think, now. But you have to be aware when you're speaking Korean of using the right level of register with the people above or below you. Well, that shapes a Korean person's experience. Like when I first had my Korean PhD student over to my house and we were having a swim party and I was barbecuing the meat, he was very troubled by the fact that I, as the professor, was doing the manual labor of cooking the meat for all my students, right? And that, you know, that's a cultural thing, but it's not unrelated to his experience of Korean as a language, is the point. Can I get a witness? Amen. Okay, right. So this was not him, but I know him as well, right? So, and you could give other examples, like in Japanese. Any Japanese speakers here? That way I could just say whatever I want, because there's no Japanese speakers here. So we don't know. Japanese doesn't have grammatical gender, but like a lot of languages we study do. But instead, men and women are expected to speak different, what are called genderlex, right? So there's a Japanese women's language called Onakotoba that has, again, different vocabulary and different endings that women are expected to speak and men would not speak. And most of the language is neutral, but again, there are separate registers that are only taught to women to use. We don't have to go into all the details, but longer versions of words that make them sound more polite. And women in Japanese are often taught to say little things that basically translate as like, please agree with me, I wonder if this is true, to be non-assertive, etc. Right? And it's another example of how the language frames and construes the world in such a way that it actually then frames and construes and shapes the society and the individual psyche of the people. Do you see what I'm saying there? And this is a universal phenomenon, is the point. And it's very different than a modernistic sort of view of linguistics that says that language has nothing to do with culture. This reine Sprache kind of notion, or Mentalese, or Chomsky would be the big person if you've ever heard of him, who would argue that. So, and we could go on and on, give other examples, but this is kind of how language and frames control. Another thing we talked about in cognitive linguistics is the idea of running scripts, and this is what I was getting at a little bit, or started to talk about with. We could use the example of house again, that we know, both thinking about it philosophically and psychologically, but also neurologically, that when we encounter language, it actually taps into our experiences and basically runs scripts of what those words mean. Let me give you an example, one that I've used in a lot of classes. My wife and I, all through college, we both grew up in game-playing families. Our family plays a lot of games together. My wife and I have played a lot of card games over the years, starting back in college. And everything from like the lowest level of it would be like spades would be the lowest level of this group of games, all the way up through, you know, hearts, and then pitch and 500. And the highest form of this group of games is bridge. And so there's a whole kind of series of games, card games of all different levels that have a kind of name to them. And do you know what they are? What all those games, what we put on all those games, what's consistent across them? Any idea? Trump games. They're all Trump games. So in some way, there's a suit that becomes Trump. But notice, when my wife and I, for the last 30 years, have been playing Trump games, what we experienced when we said that phrase has radically changed in the last 3 or 4 years, right? Because of things that happen in culture, even just within my lifetime. Now, when I say Trump games, you cannot not but think of that I'm referring to the president, or you used to have a moment of cognitive, you know, dissonance in it until your brain, and this part of the miracle of the brain and language is that it's making an initial guess at what a word means, and then it's constantly doing this equations of, does this fit with the rest of what's being said in the sentence and what's in the context, right? That's what's going on, right? And this is how humor works. I don't have time to get into all this, is that it's often an intentional cognitive, creating an intentional cognitive dissonance between situation and words, right? There's all kinds of things we can talk about related to that. But the point is, what a simple phrase like Trump games means is an example of scripts being run based on shared cultural experiences, right? And that can shift over time. And what this is acknowledging is not that you can't communicate, that's not the point at all. It's that the event of communication is a very complex thing that is not separate from people's experience of what's going on in their culture in the past or in the present, right? That makes sense? And we call that running scripts. One final thing to talk about within this, and again, I'm giving you the super short version of all this, partly because I'm not a cognitive linguist in terms of, like, I'm not trained in this or whatever, so there are far more educated people on these issues, but I'm just trying to give you an overview. One more idea to talk about that's really important in cognitive linguistics, and then we'll turn to 1 John, is the idea of prototypicality, and I need to explain just a little bit about this. Within languages, one of the things that goes way back, at least to Aristotle, is thinking about categories and how we categorize the world using words to do that. And going back to Aristotle at least, that's the kind of classic presentation of this, that things are categorized and given labels of words defined by necessary and sufficient criteria. That's the way it's talked about, necessary and sufficient criteria. So an item or a thing or an idea is in a category of linguistic category if there's something inherent about it that it shares with all the other members of that category. Let me give you an instance, a square. So we could categorize a square as a closed flat figure that all sides are equal in length, all interior angles are equal. And then we would define a square as that anything that is a square has to have it necessarily has those criteria, right? And once you understand that and define a square that way, then all the other things you might encounter that could be variations on it, as long as they all share those criteria, it is a square by definition, okay? That sort of Aristotelian notion of how to categorize the world has had a major influence all the way up into modern linguistics, such that modern linguists, Chomsky and others, or someone from Bible translation world, Eugene Nida, very influential in the Bible translation world, would hold to this kind of understanding of how categorization of language works, so that every word and every concept is defined by a set of necessary and sufficient criteria. And in linguistics, a lot of times you'll see this kind of plus and minus system. So for example, words and concepts are organized this way. So you've got boy, man, girl, woman, and these can be defined. This is what linguistic nerds kind of do. They are defined by pluses and minuses. A boy would be plus male, minus adult. And we can come up with others where a man would be plus male plus adult, right? And you know, minus female or something like that in both these cases. A girl would be minus male, or you could switch it around and do, you know, female is the plus or minus, minus adult, etc. You get the idea. So this is one way to approach languages that is basically underneath most modern forms of linguistics. Chomsky and Eugene Nida would be the person in our kind of world in Bible translation, that everything is defined by criteria of binaries, it is or is not, and all words are defined in kind of relationship to each other. Well, a cognitive linguistic view, I won't get into all the reasons why this doesn't work in the real world, but a cognitive linguistic view would instead critique this way of seeing how languages and linguistics are structured, and instead argue for the idea of prototypicality. That is, that a word or a group of words and the way the world is structured in our minds is that a particular item within a category doesn't have to share all the characteristics. It's not defined in a binary way, but there is an overlapping of shared characteristics, but then there's also always exceptions. So let me again stop speaking abstractly and give you an example. Furniture. If I put a picture up here of a chair and a couch and a bunch of other things, you would immediately say those are furniture. But what if on that picture I also had a refrigerator? Is that furniture? And why or why not? And what about a wastebasket and a television, right? You have to start thinking, or take another example, games. Like, how do you define what a game is? You know, you have to have an opponent or not or whatever. You can go through all these kind of things. What you're going to find, kind of like the reality of genre with literature, it doesn't really work that our minds work and use concepts in this kind of binary way. The reality is things overlap with other things. And one of the most fascinating stuff, and I think I put this book in the bibliography, Bergen's Louder Than Words. He runs the lab on sociolinguistics, or whatever it's called, in California, one of the universities of California, and he does all these neurological studies about how when we encounter a word like furniture, that primes our brains to think in this kind of family of ideas of furniture. And if you put diodes on people's brains, they will respond more or less quickly to whether a word fits in that category based on what words you've given them before as frames, is the point. You can read all the studies in Bergen. It's a very fun book to read. So the point that I'm making here is that, again, this is an important part of cognitive linguistic understanding, is that words and help us conceptualize the world, but in a kind of family resemblance way, not in a binary way that a word means this, not that, and they're all in this kind of binary relationship. Instead, words, again, have a family resemblance. Another example before we move on would be bird. Like a prototypical bird might be something like a robin, and we can identify things, has wings, you know, doesn't carry a machine gun. You know, we can come up with all kinds of things it might say. But then that, if that's prototypical, though, as you begin to think about other examples, ostrich, okay, well, it has some of those characteristics, but not. Or bat, right? It shares some. So instead of thinking of everything as a binary in this Aristotelian sense, it's better to say we have this prototypical idea of what a bird is, and then all these other things that we experience in the world have some family resemblance to them enough to call them all birds or not. And the reason that matters for us is because, again, notice, and this is cognitive linguistics insight, what you perceive to be the prototypical example of a word is deeply dependent on your own cultural embeddedness and your language. So for example, furniture, what you and I think would go in that category, and we might struggle a little bit with whether refrigerator goes in that or not, but that is all based on our current modern sense of what furniture is. Like, that's not like a universal norm. In Japan, if you did a similar thing, what furniture means would evoke, and they'd have a different sort of set of categories for that. Or if you think about 100 years ago, or 500 years ago, or 1,000 years ago, those categorizations, even those prototypical categorizations, are embedded in culture, is the point. Okay? And that's very different than this kind of modern, based in Aristotle notion of categorization. So, all that to say, what does this mean? Let me come back to English now and say, when I say, for example, the word church, we know that a lot of stuff happens in your brains, right, that is based on your experience, right? And then notice when I put that word church into some prepositional phrases, like, I don't know if you've pondered these, by the church, in the church, or in church. Have you ever pondered what the difference between in the church and in church is? It's interesting to ponder that. Or how about these sentences? I'm going to church, I'm going to a church, and I'm going to the church. Have you ever pondered the difference between those in current English? I'm going to church, I'm going to a church, I'm going to the church. What do you think? That's really helpful. Those words I've scribbled up there. But what's the difference between those? Can you just ponder that? Speakers of English, native or non? What's the difference between saying I go to church, I go to a church, I go to the church?
One is more general and it goes down and becomes more specific.
Okay, well, I mean, we can certainly identify, you know, anarthrous in Greek terms, indefinite, definite. But I mean, like, what do these communicate more than sort of just at the level of the syntax? Like, what do these communicate, Andre?
I think when I hear, like, a church, there's almost, like, a external, doesn't belong to me, new, unknown question, or just, like, I'm not sure.
Yeah, so I'm going to a church. Yeah, maybe there's an external, there's a kind of a distancing yourself from it a little bit. Mm-hmm. Okay? Yeah, keep going. What else do you mean? Go ahead.
Yeah. It's interesting when I say I'm going to church. I would never say, I'm going to church, and anarthrous, for me, mentally, is specific. It's my church. It's where I attend. I don't need to have
And are you referring to the physical building or to
regular church attendance.
I would say I'm about to go to the service. So
So it's not so much the so it's not so much exactly the building. Where if you said I'm going to the church, that's the building, right? Yeah. Where if we say I'm going to church, I think that's not referring to the buildings, it's referring to attendance, like regular attendance.
And the church distances in my mind from the service itself. Like I'm going there because I need to pick something up.
Right, yeah.
Or for practice, okay. Something good. Separate from the
attendance. Yeah, thanks. So maybe a couple more comments? Yeah.
Well, I can see what you're talking about is individual experience. Because for some people, you know, they are members of the Baptist Church or something. Other people, they meet in a living room.
Right.
That's church.
Right. Okay. Yeah, good. So I'm going to come back to that. One more comment.
Yep. The context of the setup.
Yeah, the context matters too. Yeah. Who you're responding to, if your mom calls you, are you going to church somewhere? I'm going to a church, right? Or something like that, right? There might be some context, right?
Preacher.
The point is that, I want to say it's not entirely individual because even though it is based on my experience, we're still able to communicate with each other, right? I mean, it's not just my experience, it's our shared experience of how we use these phrases, okay? So it's not just me. But it's our shared current cultural use of these phrases. But notice these, and we could spend more time kind of thinking about the nuances of them, but notice none of those things that we're able to say about the nuances, especially native speakers, probably non-native speakers, you're probably not really sure about the difference between these as well, right? Why? Not because any of us have struggle identifying that this is a noun and these are articles. It's because the way language works is not just a function of putting the pieces together of the syntax, right? Of what an article means when you put it in front of it or something like that. What these phrases mean is a function of how we use them in culture, right? Like there's nothing inherently in the nature of saying I'm going to a church that in the syntax of that communicates that some kind of distance between my commitment to the church and I mean, there's nothing in the syntax or the words that do that. That's a decision. Well, not even a decision. It's just a function of how we currently have started to use that expression in our current culture. Do you get that? And again, it's not individualized. I mean, we all kind of know it, unless you're a non-native speaker. I'm curious, non-native speakers, would you have gotten those nuances? Depends on how long you've been here, I guess, right? And just how long you've been in the language. But notice, that's the point. The way language communicates, or the way language works, is part of the society in which it exists. Now, hear me clearly. That doesn't mean we can't understand people in other societies or across time, like the Bible. We can. But it does mean, as you guys probably all know, and that's why you're here, you cannot assume that how we use certain prepositional phrases or something is how the Bible is going to use them. Right? And this is why translation is treason, always, right? As the saying goes, that it's not that you can't translate, it's just that what our whole goal is in Greek and Hebrew, and why you're here for this conference, is not to learn to translate per se, but it's actually to learn to read Greek and Hebrew. And once you've done that, then to say, how do we say the same thing in English? Right, it's not to say, how do I gloss each of these words and how to kind of literally translate them or something. Most of you probably are aware of that. But it's to say Greek is functioning in a certain way in a certain culture with a bunch of cultural values, too, that are quite different than ours at points. Doing as much work as we can to understand how this text is communicating and then saying, and then how do we say the same thing in English? Which is what the role of translators are and what the role of pastors and teachers of all sorts is to say, what is God saying in his own context that he's inspired to choose to write the Bible in Hebrew and Greek, a little Aramaic, in there in these certain time frames, doing the labor to understand the complexities, really, quite honestly, of how language functions in an embedded culture, and then do the work of being a translator. Really, pastors are translators. Right? They're translators of God's word in its original reality into today's reality. That's what the work of theology is, to quote John Frame. It's reading Holy Scripture anew in each generation into the current context. That's really what theology is. Okay, so question?
Well, I was going to say another way to interpret that or be deceptive is to name your bed church. Mom calls and says, I was in church all morning.
Yes, I was in church, right? So you could certainly use language to deceive as well. That's right. Okay, so let me then, in our remaining time, let me just turn. I hope my goal in this is to really just kind of expose you to these issues of language, and you chose to come, so there you go. But I've given you some bibliography there that is a starting place at least, and again, I can't claim to be, you know, I'm not a cognitive linguist, but there's some helpful stuff on there. And the reason this all came to mind to me is, so I've been teaching Greek for quite a few years already, and I'm, you know, the son of an Englishman, literally, so I always have kind of loved language. Anyways, but over several years in teaching Greek here and other places, these things were dawning on me as I would teach students to translate and read texts and just continue to do my study of recognizing the complexity of translation, not the impossibility. You can certainly translate, but the complexity of it. A lot of these things were banging around in my head for a while, and I would teach various ways of saying it, but my life was really changed, here's my conversion story, to cognitive linguistics when I prayed to receive cognitive linguistics into my heart in the summer of 2017, so about a year and a half ago. I was invited to come to a conference at Tyndale House in Cambridge with Steve Runge, you may know that name, and some other friends, Will Ross and others, on cognitive linguistics and Greek prepositions. So talk about in Cambridge, England. So it was, you know, I wouldn't care what the conference was. I've always enjoyed going to Cambridge, so that was for sure worth it. But even so, that was, you know, sounded pretty interesting. So I just went not as a cognitive linguist. There were real cognitive linguists there, including, I never know how to say his name, but Dirk Gaardus, it's his Dutch name, who is one of the editors of the Oxford Handbook on Cognitive Linguistics. He was there. I mean, there were only like 40 of us there. It was pretty amazing. And he was one of the main speakers, and a bunch of other people as well. A student of George Lakoff's was there and others. And so I was just there as the New Testament guy, to me and Aaron Heim, who was also there as a New Testament person, to listen to all the papers and then by all these linguists and then just kind of say, okay, sounds good, you know, or whatever. But the best thing was that we were assigned all this reading to do beforehand from the Oxford Handbook and all this on cognitive linguistics. I had already read George Lakoff, so that helped. But I had to do all this reading in preparation, and I realized that all these things I had been stumbling towards was exactly what they were saying. Just my experience with multiple languages and translating Greek and teaching Greek, that this started to make sense and gave a frame and a construal of understanding what was really happening in language. So in the last 18 months, I've spent a lot of time reading more in this area and thinking about the application of it as well. And so then all of those papers that we gave at the conference are going to be in a volume on cognitive linguistics and Greek prepositions. And so what I did is, after I gave my initial remarks, then over the next several months, I went back and did a little bit of work on it as applied to 1 John, and that's what I want to just take a few minutes, sharing with you. So the title is Cognitive Linguistics and Prepositions in 1 John. So it's heavy on that, which is fine. But it's quite okay, and I've printed a little bit of the paper there for you as well. But basically, what I did is, because I had taught 1 John probably 25 times, you know, in Greek syntax classes, and one of the things that I noticed in teaching 1 John over and over and over, and 1 John is so deceptive, isn't it? I mean, in the sense that the Greek is really easy, and it's really very non-normal Koine Greek. If you've read 1 John at all, you may notice one of the most obvious things that's different about the Johannine literature versus the rest of Koine Greek is that almost all the participles in the Johannine literature are substantive. Does that mean something to you all, right? Where adverbial participles are the norm in Greek, but almost all the participles are substantive. So, you know, ha legon, the one who says, etc. The Johannine literature uses the participles in a pretty non-typical way, that is, frequency-wise. So that's one thing that's interesting about it. So John's language is very simple, but then when you start to ask, this is how it's, you know, quote unquote deceptive. When you start to ask, what does he really mean by these phrases? You realize John is like incredibly profound and mysterious, just like the Gospel of John is as well, talking about 1 John here, that the language is simple on the surface, but it turns out to be the sort of the most complex theological ideas really in all of the New Testament, I think. And so I began to notice this with a couple of prepositions, ek and en, and let me just say something about them. In the case of ek, 1 John has a very high number of occurrences. Over 20 times he uses ek phrases in his short epistle. And more important than mere frequency is that I think he's using that, he's in a kind of prototypical way of an intentional usage to emphasize not so much the spatial idea of out of, like you might think of as the prototypical gloss, but at least for John, the prototypical use of ek, the kind of core one, is about origin. And I give you a little chart here. If you look at the ek phrases throughout 1 John, they're all about origin. That is not about from in the spatial sense, but like one's very identity because of one's source ontologically, we might even say, right? That's not going to be a good translation of it, right? But the idea, and that they all fall into two categories, these columns here. People are either aligned with God, they are ek to patras, they are ek to, or I'm sorry, ek tes aletheos, I guess it would be ek to theou quite a few times in 3:9, ek to theou, of the spirit, so ek to pneumatos, etc. Tons of those, and they're all like identity, they're your ontological nature, versus your people are ek to cosmu, or ek to diabolu, ek to paneru, right, would be all the aligned with the devil or evil one in the world. And this sharp contrast, I think, is part of John's whole kind of theological construct, and it, and again, to use, to speak from cognitive linguistic category or framing, it both reveals and affects the way he conceptualizes the world, right, for his readers, where everything is on this, what we call an oppositional dualism. And that's one of the things that's very clear about the Johannine literature, is that everything is really stark. There's no middle ground in the Johannine literature. So, for example, do you remember what happens in John 8:44 when, unique to John, when his enemies come to him and say, we have Abraham as our father. And he doesn't say, yeah, but you also need to believe. No, he says, no, the devil's your father, right? I mean, this is your ek tu diabolu. This is how the Johannine literature works. And if you read 1 John, that's how it is. It's like you are either of God or you're of the devil. Everything's very stark. And the point is, I'm trying to make is, and you don't need cognitive linguistics to understand this, but I'm trying to help you understand it from that perspective, that is that this, again, both reflects and affects a sort of a gestalt, a way of seeing the world, a way of conceptualizing and communicating the world. And it's really built and communicated deeply through this very elaborate set of ek prepositions that are almost never, if ever, used in what we would typically think of in a spatial sense. They're used in this ontological or origin sense. Does that make sense? Okay. And when you look at N, and I'm not going to have time to go through all this, but I print off some of what I say here. N is an interesting situation as well, because it can be locative as well, but a lot of times in 1 John, the N language is used in this one particular phrase, in tuto, which when you look at the translations in English, it's translated a whole bunch of different ways, but I would suggest to you, and I give you some of the argument for it, and the rest will be in this book eventually, that what he means by it every time or almost every time is actually by this. In other words, he uses it as part of a logical argumentation all throughout, and there are several of them. For example, I think I give you these, that may prove they may look like exceptions to that, and when you look at the translations, they don't usually translate them as by this. But once you start paying attention to John's idiolect, which just means an individual way a person tends to speak, an idiolect, and we all have our own kind of certain things we say. My wife makes fun of certain things I say in my idiolect all the time, and maybe your spouse does the same thing for you. But John's particular idiolect uses in tuto to make logical arguments if not always, almost always. And then once you sort of recognize that, that for him the prototypical use of N tuto is to make this kind of argument, then when you look at some of the other ones that are not translated that way, it doesn't mean that, I mean, they could be exceptions, but at least inclines you to say, maybe those also should be understood in this sort of same argumentation kind of way. Does that make sense? And you have to take them on a case-by-case basis, because in an idiolect, any of us can say whatever we want. We're free speakers, right? You can say things in the way you don't typically say them. But the idea of prototypicality helps us understand that even though the usages don't have to be identical with each other, there tends to be a way that a person is going to say something and a culture is going to say something, and that is the starting point to sort of understand what's going on. Okay? And I don't have time to give you any more details than that. So I'll just conclude there, recommend to you that some sources for further reading, and of course, to sincerely say to you, the most important thing is to say that you know, we have this amazing gift and opportunity, especially those of us here, to read the Bible in the original languages. And that is an amazing gift that most people throughout human history have not had, or today don't have. It's a labor, it's a work, but it is worth it. And I want to encourage you that God is happy to speak even through our very imperfect understanding, right? We don't have to be a Greek or Hebrew expert to be a great teacher and preacher, but the more we give ourselves to this labor, the more it'll enable us to see the riches of and the complexity of what's going on. And I think anyone who's called to be a teacher or leader should give themselves to that labor as part of their calling. So thank you. Sorry we don't have time for questions. I'll stick around for a few minutes, though. Thanks a lot for joining.